Hello and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour and I'm joined by Mark Christensen. How are you, Mark?
I'm doing very well, Mike. Thank you. How are you?
Good, good. It's actually a public holiday here in Australia, which makes it a very relaxing day. So the weather is nice.
What is that holiday,
Mark? We are celebrating the Queen of Australia's birthday.
Queen?
Mm-hmm. Our Queen.
Huh. Wow.
Yes. She happens to also be the Queen of the United Kingdom and several other places, but, you know.
Now I'm catching on. Yes. It's a borrowed queen. Well, that's great. Are they celebrating that in the UK too?
No. I think we uniquely celebrate it when it isn't her birthday, just to be kind of fun about it.
Oh, good.
So, you know. So we are talking this week about the Prince of Persia, Sands of something. Sands of Time. And this is a interesting film for many respects, not least of which is because I remember playing this as a kid's game. Did you ever play this, Mark?
Yeah, I did as well.
So did that influence your view of the film before you sort of saw it? I mean, does that make for a bad vibe these days or a good vibe?
Well, I think the reputation of video games turned into movies is legion. I think the record stands for itself. I forgot all about it at the point I finally came to watching the movie. I made almost no association between the two. How about you?
I had fond memories of the game, and I thought that the amount of jumping he did around things suddenly became valid with that perspective, because obviously the principal character, who is vastly more fleshed out than my Nintendo 64 game was, is a prince that used to be on the streets as a child and was sort of adopted. And as a consequence, he's quite athletic, he's quite rebellious, and he literally leaps around a lot, which is central to the video game since I think it was ever invented, this whole kind of leaping thing. And I thought that I'm a little cynical of these type of films, full stop. Not as much as I am if it had been a ride at Disneyland. But then, as I said, I've been corrected on that one because obviously Pirates of the Caribbean turned out to be a jolly good film, so I've had to eat my words. But I guess, yeah, I would normally be, I don't want to see any video game turned into a film. But I think that the jumping, running around castles in a period sort of setting is a lot better than a point of view shoot 'em up game. A Halo, the film kind of thing doesn't, I think, work even vaguely well. I've never seen anything like that work well.
Yeah, I agree. This film is in the proud tradition of the Hollywood exotic epic, which in VFX terms goes back at least to Thief of Baghdad, which is going pretty much all the way back.
Yeah, it is. And it's also interesting, I guess, because it's a Jerry Bruckheimer film. And before we get to the visual effects, we like to discuss the film. So let's do that. I'm not a big Jerry Bruckheimer fan on the whole. I guess at the point, I think it was Con Air. Was Jerry Bruckheimer Con Air? I think he was. Mm. I think that was the point that I got soured.
That before or after Armageddon?
Yeah, I had actually blotted that out. I guess one of the reasons is that it tends to be, for me, films that are much more sort of style over content, and I don't really tend to engage much. Having said that, I was interested in this film because when I was driving to work one day and I was taking my kids to school, they pointed out this was a Disney film. And it struck me that going back just a few years ago, there were actually no Disney films that were released that weren't G-rated. Now, this film wasn't R-rated, but it wasn't G-rated, and it was interestingly branded as a Disney film, and a Jerry Bruckheimer as that. And I guess this all comes from turning points with Pirates of the Caribbean. But I understand the need for some kind of association to get you to. But I just don't know whether the Prince of Persia game was that strong a lead-in as opposed to, you know, some of the other ones like Charlie's Angels or whatever, which were obviously lifted from a TV show, and that would be the only reason to see it. So I was okay with it being a game, but I was more nervous about it being a Jerry Bruckheimer film than I was about it being a game. So what did you think of the film? Just before you get onto the visual effects, what did you actually think of it?
I thought it was a pretty awful movie with amazing visuals, and I felt like it showed most of the chinks in Jerry Bruckheimer's armor. it looked to me like it was an attempt to take the success of the original Pirates of the Caribbean film, the first one, and marry that to something like, I don't know, Kingdom of Heaven. And, you know, it's full of the tropes of the genre. Everyone's speaking with a British accent. You've got the chorus of extras, including the dudes with the trumpets that don't have any buttons on them. And unfortunately, the humorlessness for the most part. And then there's an attempt to bring some humor in somewhere in the second act. They try to do a little screwball comedy between Jake Gyllenhaal and Gemma Arterton, who I always want to say Atherton because I grew up next to a town with that name. And you got Alfred Molina in there as well to be the kind of wacky Sheikh Amar character. But it you know, the problem, I guess, is Jake Gyllenhaal and Alfred Molina together don't make Johnny Depp. And the leading lady is lovely, but, you know, she's not really Liz Taylor, let alone Keira Knightley. And I Jordan Mechner versus Elliot and Rossio is like polar opposites.
I don't think it was as good as the first Pirates film, but I do think it was enjoyable. And I guess as I wasn't going expecting anything great, I was certainly not sitting there going, oh my God, how long till this darn thing finishes? I thought the leads were appropriate for this kind of film because, let's face it, you and I aren't the target demographic. And we really, you know, I mean, it was a young teens film, right? And that's fine. I don't have any problem with that. And so let's agree that we weren't the target demographic. I don't think I probably would have seen this film had I not been wanting to review it for the VFX show.
Well, I do. I mean, I'm going to say, though, that I think some things about how the film was made undermined the VFX work, unfortunately.
Oh, really?
Well, we can get to that.
No, but...
Well, I mean, in general, I would say using so much exposition to tell the story instead of showing it is a bit of a no-no. But I also think that a lot of the camera work undermined some really nice digital matte work. And I even felt like some of the stunt work, which, I mean, I love good parkour, but something about this film felt so cluttered and phony when it came to a lot of the stunt work that, I don't know, I didn't enjoy it as much as in Casino Royale, which, you know, I thought was a real tour de force of that type of work.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. It's that was a better sequence and a better... But having said that, I bought into it because I remember the game and the jumping thing just didn't bug me. And it was this sort of... And also, you know, I was in a place where I was totally accepting of the fact that it was very much a fantasy film where I was just hoping they weren't going to go too far in making things ridiculously unrealistic. Look, let's move to the visual effects because it is a relatively decent visual effects kind of 1200 effect shoot, and I think there's no other place to start than the rewind sequence. But for those of you that haven't seen it or perhaps have only seen the trailer, this is the pressing the button on the dagger. It causes time to rewind, and that sounds okay written on paper, but it's actually an interesting problem to solve. How does a character experience going back in time when the character needs to be self-aware of the fact that time has passed? And I want to discuss that because I think it's interesting. It's easy enough to reverse things. If the character was unaware of it and that they were themselves walking backwards, well, that was particularly easy. We've probably seen that in 1,000 films. The question is really, how do you pull that off when the character needs to witness that as well? And I think the solution that the British houses came up with, because I'm going to say the British houses, it's a bit of a... The British club of MPC, double negative frame store, the, you know, CineSite, all good facilities, don't get me wrong, but another classic case of the UK Soho houses coming together on mass. And I think it was good. I think it was a good solution. It stuck with the name of the film, which is it had a sand thing. It looked impressive. It looked very engagingly magical without just being completely flashing and god rays. What do you think?
Yeah, actually, I would go even further to say that that effect has the potential to be kind of a breakthrough. I mean, it moves a technique forward into a realm where they really met the problem in a way that I find fascinating, in that they thought about what it would mean in a, almost an Einstein physics way to observe a kind of blend of time and what that would mean to light blending. And so they imagined a sequence of time, if it could go in infinite directions, kind of spreading out as, you could think of it as overlapping frames, but it looks more like smears of light and particles. And the way they actually did it was closer to that as well. And I think that technique, which was used, I think, first... this is MPC, by the way, we're talking about. Or DNEG, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, I thought really, DNEG designed the... DNEG.
And that was Quantum of Solace, where they trotted that out for the skydiving sequence, which I remember talking about on this show, and we weren't totally psyched with it at that time, but they've really moved it forward here. And I suppose we should really get into more what they actually did to set this up.
Let's discuss it. And if that is... if that is the case, that it was an extension of the same technique as Quantum of Solace, then I couldn't agree with you more. It's I would have given that a 4 out of 10, and I'd have given this a 9.5 out of 10. I think it was... I wasn't watching it saying, oh my God, I've got no idea how they're going to ever pull this off. It wasn't one of those moments for me where my jaw hit the floor, but I definitely think they nailed it. And for a hero effect to sell the film's title... I think it was a very, very, very good performance from the effects team. So should we run through it? There were like 9 Arriflex 435 cameras used?
Yeah, yeah. Shooting 48 FPS, so they were getting as overcranked, I guess, as you could on that camera with a 90-degree shutter, so they didn't break the laws of camera shutter.
Actually, I think they had a 45-degree shutter to actually reduce motion blur from my research.
Oh, okay. All
yeah,
right.
To get it even
mine
sharper.
Differently. Yeah. That's right. They did need as sharp and as minimal a depth of field image, because that was both. Those are both things they could basically add later, and so they were looking for a really, I guess, clean capture of basically the scene, so that it could then be remapped, and they could even in between. So I think one way to imagine it is like if you're familiar with bullet time and the array of the radial array of cameras used for bullet time. If you do that with overcranked moving picture film cameras, and then you have the ability to then in between positions, and really even go further than that, I think, but as a starting point, just get positions in between those cameras. And there's a few technical problems, I guess, with that, like specular highlights don't move smoothly between the camera position, so those have to be kind of painted back in. But in any case, you get a bullet time like smooth arc around the action of the character, which can then be placed in a different scene. Plus, and the plus part is that they did these effects of essentially a really nice displacement effect of the character basically backing out of, I'm going to say himself because I think it was always a guy, and backing out of himself. And with this really, I think artistically and dramatically interesting kind of reaction, like how shocking would it be to back out of your, say, dying body and be able to go back in time? And, then the way I guess they ended up doing it was actually basically recreating that whole figure as full CG with actually even doing facial mapping, which I didn't pick at all, by the way. I bought it. I mean, to me, it just looked like really cool looking footage.
Yeah, I mean, if I thought the effect on screen was a 9.5, I thought the implementation of the effect was like a 9.9. I didn't see anything. And interestingly for the actors, it was about 2 hours to set up for each one of these takes. So they would have the actors on stage literally for like 20 minutes. They'd do a take, and then they would come back in a couple of hours when we reset again. So it was a very complex setup, obviously very well pre-visualized and sequenced through animatics to get that for main unit to know what was going to be happening. And all round, I think, just a huge success. I do like that the design, as I mentioned earlier, really was in keeping with the idea of the sands in the dagger, the sands in the name of the film. It didn't feel like someone had just, you know, come up with some really cool effect that was gratuitous. It, you know, felt like there was, in the context of this film, the sort of visual effect that worked for the story, and it was a hero effect that needed to work, otherwise it would have been pretty hopeless. So I liked
it. Yeah, I mean, not only that, I look at the last sequence and I imagine somebody coming and saying, okay, we need there to be this sequence where doing this certain thing with this dagger, and by the way, my working title for this film would have been Dagger, Dagger, Who's Got the Dagger? So this dagger is going to cause Armageddon here at the end. You know, so like we're gonna end the world, but then in the middle of it, the guy's going to pull it out and he's going to instead... Well, I don't want to give away the whole ending, but
no, you can. We deliberately put out the VFX.
He's going to send himself magically right back to the beginning of the film.
Yeah,
and I would have looked at that and gone, "Ugh, yeah, that's a tough brief." So, it's true that the effect itself did a really nice job of tying in. I also actually felt like I don't remember if it was Dineg that did Golden Compass, but it reminded me a lot of besides the really nice creature work in Golden Compass, some of the stuff I really liked in that movie, which was, again, a time thing where they're diving into the watch, and there was, again, just really nice particle design stuff happening that had this really cinematic quality to it. So I don't even know for sure if it was Dineg or one of the other London houses that did that one.
Yeah, I've got to say, you touched there briefly on the end sequence. I guess I was still focused on just the dagger stuff. Mm-hmm. I don't know that it was Dineg that worked, by the way, on the Golden Compass.
See, I just don't remember sequence. That.
I have that one in my head as like Framestore CineSite, but I don't know. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong, but I don't have that as a Dineg film. There was a ton of people on that film. I remember like Digital Domain and Rainmaker and Matwell Digital, but I just...
Well, I had it in my mind as being the London houses again, all kind of gang up together.
Well, Rhythm and Hughes also worked on it, so I think it was both London and right. Golden Compass. But hey, look, I agree with you, the Golden Compass stuff was gorgeous. I don't know I would carry the same weight of appropriate impressed brilliance to the end giant rock pulling the dagger out sequence, because for me at that point I had kind of gone so over the top. I was losing it when there was such a vast cavern beneath the castle that you could have, you know, it was Lord of the Rings scale of the collapsing floor, castle, sand. And that was so OTT that to then have this entire giant golden nugget.
You saw the rock, right? Where it turned out there was this Indiana Jones-like basically roller coaster ride under Alcatraz. That was another Bruckheimer film.
Yeah,
he obviously, it's like the black helicopters in the Michael Bay films. It's obviously one of the things he really likes.
And in exactly, there's a particularly good reference, because in exactly the same way I found that absurd, having been on Alcatraz, there's just no concept of there being that kind of, you know, it's just stupid. Well, you live there, so, you know, it's just...
well, I don't live in Alcatraz,
right.
But yeah.
No, but you live in San Francisco.
Maybe I should. Yeah, anyway.
So I'd line of lost it by that point. And then it was so OTT. I didn't think it needed to be. I mean, I didn't think that the central thing needed to be that big. There's something to be said for, you know, big finishes, and I get that. You don't want to have the audience feeling like you ran out of money on the ending. But I just feel that whereas there was such a level of appropriateness, I honestly felt by the time he'd had that skidding down the sand at the end, it was just such a big visual effect, so big in sense of the scale of the items that they were dealing with. And, you know, I was sort of like, I no longer had kind of a real buy-in.
It went both directions, because the chasm was over the top, but then what's actually happening is the world's supposed to be ending, and it's basically a wrestling match between two dudes to pull a dagger out of a cliff.
But I mean, Jake, or his character, had... so athletically solved every other challenge put in front of him that, you know, Gandhi could stop him. Seems slightly improbable to me. But anyway. Yeah.
Well, there was some other nice looking stuff happening.
Yeah, look, once they did the reversing of time at the end of the wrestling match, I agree, the visual effects were good. And I totally believe that it was not the fault of the effects houses that I didn't like, because again, it was implemented very well. It wasn't like there were bad matte lines or anything. I just didn't like this vast golden nugget thing that they found after having fallen several thousand feet into a seemingly an endless chasm of cascading ancient ruins. Are there any ancient ruins left, by the way? Everyone seems to wreck them in every film.
No, so, it couldn't be. It's like New York City. It's gone too.
But there's two things I want to discuss in this film outside the film of itself, and they both obviously relate to the film. One is the idea of the London houses, because it just seems to me that this is a collaborative group of artists and companies that, rather than cut each other's throat, just seem to collaborate again and again and again to produce outstanding work. And the second thing is the particle work, which, and I mentioned this in Clash of the Titans because I thought the particle work there was so good, but for adding production value, nothing seems to really make something credible and interesting and give it depth like some really great particle work. And I reference now the assassins or the ninjas. I mean, there was sort of almost no reason for them to have clouds of dust and stuff going on, and yet it really helped their sequences, didn't you think?
Yeah, and the amount, I mean, dust storms, right, are a big part of this whole story. They all looked fantastic. The digimat work, when it wasn't totally undermined by stupid camera moves, cliched, you know, follow the harpoon to the city wall type shot. I mean, that was the one where I knew we were in trouble as soon as I saw that shot. And then there was a whole bunch of them after that, you know, like the 360 around the courtyard. Just like, again, I mean, what it says, it's like the golden nugget thing you were talking about. It undermines the confidence that the visuals are good enough, which is really kind of pathetic.
Okay, but I grant you that, but get me back to the particles.
Yeah, getting back to the particles.
If you and I were making a film right now, and it was any sort of film that was outside a realistic, gritty drama, if you can get a good particle team, a good animation effects team on, it really adds production value.
Yeah, and so I was getting to was there, you know, maybe my, I mean, I don't know if it's my favorite shot in the film because it has nothing to do. We should make it clear now that we're talking not only about the particles that were used completely for an imaginary effect, but now about the ones that were used to sell exteriors. And there's a digimat of Alamut, which is kind of the central location of the film outside of, you know, where the movie starts. And, you know, it's, I mean, I was looking at this shot, and not only does it just have an extraordinary amount of detail that would have, I don't, you know, it wouldn't have been possible. Just the city itself, say 6 or 7 years ago, would have been a big, big ask, right?
Oh, it would have been a miniature, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, it's got a nice crane, dolly crane move on it. Mm-hmm. And then, but what really sells it is exactly that. It's the swirling, you know, there's not just natural atmospheric haze behind it or something boring like that. It's like this mystical place where, like, over here on the right side, there's like clearly somebody's burning some leaves or something, because there's kind of a haze hanging over that, and then the whole back area's got this kind of swirling thing going on. It just rocked. It looks so good.
I guess for me, if you were to pick out two highlights of this film for visual effects, one would be the non-end giant nugget time effect, which I think in the general sense, when he stabs himself, when earlier in the film he discovers the effect, they were spot on. The second thing that adds just so much production value to this film is just general particle effects work. It's not the sexiest thing to talk about, but I just can't get over how much this film would have looked lame, how many films would look lame if it didn't have that level of really superb, nicely handled, subtle and believable particle effects.
Let me ask you something. They used, MPC has this Alice sim, right, that they use. It's kind of like they're massive, I guess. Yep. And I was looking at the crowds in this, and, you know, these are casts of thousands type crowds, like Lord of the Rings. And in Lord of the Rings, especially in the first one, the clouds of dust and things were kind of a big missing element there. That in this film, obviously, was just essential, because these guys are no longer in Mordor or whatever. They're cruising across the desert.
Yep.
And it really, again, with the crowd sims, I would say, again, the particles, I mean, I had this thought watching it. It was like, it was the particles that I thought were really making this work. Do you think that the crowd sims as well are that much better to be supporting it, or am I really just seeing better
they are work? Part of the reason is that a crowd sim, and I'm not necessarily talking about Alice, but crowd sims generally, when you go back to Lord of the Rings, the sims existed over an imaginary plane. They were very rarely interacting with the plane, such as causing footprints, leaving wakes for boats, that kind of stuff. And over the last X number of years since the original Lord of the Rings and the massive work, the agents have become not only better in terms of self-aware and performance and modeling of the agent themselves, but their interaction with the real world has really lifted, and that leads you to being able to have such detailed particles. And also, these particle things we're talking about, bloody expensive. I mean, computer-wise, bloody mm-hmm. expensive.
Yeah.
So I think if you were doing vast sims of an army, you tended to put in, you know, almost like repeat library smoke elements, dust elements to sort of pad it out, to give it depth and stuff, as opposed to what I believe was happening from what I could judge in this film, which was very much a ton of particle generators and original linked animation to original linked Alice massive type movement. And it's not only in that sequence. I also think our assassins, they really benefited from having this storm thing. It gave them a foreboding. It gave them all the mystery and stuff. It mm-hmm. just made those sequences great. There's obviously the magical particle stuff, the Sands of Time type stuff. And there's just tons of shots that you have to sort of look off in the distance and realize, oh, yeah, there's a bunch of stuff going off there that had to have been computer added just to, like a set extension virtually, to give it depth. And as you're saying, there's giant matte shots where there was so much detailed work that stood up so well to scrutiny. I think it's the case now that, you know, you always look for what does it would take to plus a shot, like what it would, if I was putting a team together, I said earlier, I'm now at a point that I'd be like, I want a really killer, two teams, really killer fluid sims team, if we've got any fluids, because that can really let a film down. And I want a really, really good effects animation team. I honestly think they can sell in a shot. It can make 3D blend better with live action. It can make the story just be carried along a bit more. That destruction of the city, which was, of course, alluded to earlier in the film when they, and I think they replayed the same shot twice, when they had that sort of aerial shot looking down and the storms were smashing through the front gates of the city, and that was 2012 level destruction footage. Mm-hmm. And of course, to me, as a bit of a cynic, looked like a trailer shot, looked like this is a great shot to put in the trailer. And you know what? I mean, you have to do that to sell movie tickets. I don't have a problem with that. But it was in of its own right. You could put those two, three shots as those clouds hit the city on a showreel and then put your phone number at the end and say, thanks for playing.
Yeah, totally. What about now, with your short list of two things you're looking for, that leaves out, for example, lighting. So, and obviously we both know lighting is very important, but does that just mean that lighting is not as difficult a request now? Because there certainly was really nice lighting work to accompany everything we're talking about.
Yeah, I guess for me, lighting is something that I've increasingly gone and approached at a technical level. Mm-hmm. HDRs, complicated lighting systems, and I take nothing away from that. But in a sense, you can build that as part of your pipeline. And if you have a really good set of TDs and a really good pipeline, you've got good HDRs, you've got good models for how the light works in the environment, then you can start to get very realistic lighting setups, which make the job of lighting, in a sense, actually easier for realism. It's less.
So it's not the amount of man hours that the particle sims require. Well, in other words,
I feel earlier on, it was so much a matter of tricking the lighting system to look good that, boy, you wanted somebody that could light, and by that you meant somebody that could analyze a scene and work out what they had to do
to fake it.
And it was very much like you were the guy at the nuclear plant working through the robotic arms, through the rubber gloves. You know, you're like two steps removed from doing it in reality. And you had to pick up the test tube, and it was very easy to get it wrong. So you'd kind of go simply and methodically and really analyze it. And so there, that lighting TD guy, just invaluable, because you couldn't tell what they'd done. It just worked. Whereas now I feel, albeit more complex as a model, it is now a more understood model. And you can get to a point where you can say, okay, look, if you know how to light from an on-set point of view, then you can probably light this up, because we're going to use HDRs of actual lights. We're going to model what was there on the day. We're going to understand Hollywood lighting. And it's not easy, but it's process solvable. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that's the case with some of this particle stuff. I don't know that the particle stuff, you just, because it's SIM-based, it's not a matter of, as weird as that sounds, it's not a scientific solution, even though it is, of course, a simulation. Right. It's what levers on the simulation. Yeah, what levers on the simulation to kind of pull.
Yeah.
And I don't even think modeling is, you know, and I think motion capture is, these are all important aspects, but I just feel like for production value, for an epic film, to give it scale and the things that you want, right now, probably one of the just key quality, and you can take a lot of things and say this, of course, but I'm just focusing on this one because I think it was so important in this film. Effects animators are just worth their weight in gold.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk about the London crowd.
Okay.
Is it me, or is it just they just seem so cooperative and so successful at being so cooperative?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any firsthand data about this, but clearly London is rocking it and getting really the lion's share of the killer jobs these days, and no one house is beating up on the others to do it. They are definitely working together, and this is, I mean, I don't even know how many films we could cite, but there's most of them over the last, what, 3 or 4 years where you see all the houses. Like, you don't see one of them.
Like that scene in Terminator where he says, the police are here. How many? All of them?
Yeah, I mean, they all show up to play, and it's kind of like, I don't even know what the process is like, whether one of them gets the award and then they go, well, you know, why don't we call our friends down, you know, down Water Street or whatever. I don't even know if I'm getting that right. You know, whatever. Yeah, I mean, down here in Soho, let's call our friends over here and see if they can help out. I mean, I don't know how, or if the studios now know to bid, you know, to send out the bid to all of them and then slice and dice it that way. Do you know?
Look, I don't. And I think it changes on a per film basis.
Sure.
But reliably, the London houses do work as a unit. You don't hear stories of them killing each other. I never, ever hear them bad-mouthing each other. And I think I'm in a position that I would, because I have a lot of off-the-record discussions with people. I think part of it is they are so geographically close. A lot of staff move from one place to another. And quite frankly, they've got friends at every facility. And so there is no longer a sense of us versus them, because it's, well, this is where I work and this is what we're on. Yeah. And our team does this and that team does that. But hey, I worked with half that team before, so I know those guys.
I wonder about that. I mean, I'm in an area that has reasonably geographically geographically close houses. And, you know, LA, okay, geography in LA is a pain. But I think there is some other possibly missing element. And actually, I will say, to its credit, I mean, the Bay Area, artists often say when they come up from LA to San Francisco that people are more collaborative here, like they're more open about sharing kind of knowledge and approaches and things like that. But there's a dynamic here where there's a couple houses that are pretty dominant, and then a lot of the others are a bit secondary and might even be getting stuff more literally like farmed out from ILM, say.
Because there's no doubt that there are, there are four houses outside the London crowd that are killer. ILM, Sony, DD, and Weta would be the, you know, and then of course there are Rhythm and Hughes,
and
a bunch
of others. Yeah, right, sure.
But all of those houses, all of them I completely respect, but I just rarely see, oh yeah, we've got a Weta, ILM, I mean, that was on Avatar, but you know, you don't normally get DD, yeah. ILM, Weta.
Well, they didn't really collaborate on that. They just all happened to work on it, you know?
Yeah, it's not that sort of, you don't get that sort of unified sense of them bidding as one. Now, I don't think there's any hostility between Weta and ILM and the other guys. I've never detected that. In fact, I've never detected anyone at ILM being a dick about any of that stuff.
No, but
nevertheless,
again, I mean, going back to what I remember about Golden Compass was they were literally passing elements back and forth in a way that is usually really difficult to coordinate between houses. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder if it's a mentality that we need to work together or we're going to be, you know, held out. In a sense, because they are the outsider. I mean, there is no doubt about it that well, on paper... they're not anymore. Well, but on paper, they were the underdogs.
Were, yeah. But you have to wonder if the LA places are going to, you know, take any tips from this example.
Because I get the sense that facilities like Weta are not in any way hostile to anybody else, but they're just so competent in their own right that you... And they are on the other side of the world. That being said, I've heard people say it's great working at Weta because if you have some group at Weta and another shot's in somewhere else, you work 24 hours a day because, you know, while Weta's working, everyone else is asleep, and then and so it goes. And look, there are a ton of other good houses around the world. Obviously, in my own backyard, Animal Logic is splendid and has done terrific animation work. Pixar, of course, at your in your backyard is first rate. But again, Pixar is like a, you know, it's a creative genius of a gem of... But yeah, it's but its own group.
It's also it's, a walled kingdom.
Yeah.
Nothing goes in and out of there.
That being said, even Pixar is collaborating on their live action stuff with the UK crowd. Well, look, something else I want to discuss with you before we move off, and it's partially VFX, partially aesthetic, which is just the grade of this film.
Yeah,
great
I was
going to say Company
that.
3.
Yeah.
Graded at Company 3, it was... from the bus sides and billboards before the film's trailer, obvious that this was going to be very distinctively graded. It was exceptionally golden in its tones. Did it work for you?
No. Look, I mean, when the flashback sequences finally came along, and we haven't mentioned the creature work, by the way, but, you know, the one with the tiger, I was so relieved because it was blue. I was at that point, I felt like I'd just been looking at the whole film in this gold-plated mirror. Like, it was all, you know, Mr. Bling Bling showed up for the film. So, I would, you know, with all due respect, no, I really did not care much for the grade. And do you have any idea why?
I'm going to go the other way. It's actually, I thought it worked really well. Okay. I was stunned at my opinion on that, because I was all ready to get Medieval on their ass over the fact that they'd done that. But, you know, it wasn't the classic... Well, you've seen the post that Stu Meshewitz did about every Hollywood film going the green-bluey path and named eight films that all looked almost identical.
Right.
This was not that. This was an original look. Yeah. And you know what? It was distinctively stylish. And I asked myself, well, why do I you know, think that's about it? Because I'm always going on about how much I like black and white films. And, you know, black and white films are just their own look. Why can't we make a film that is as uniquely styled in terms of its grade as this one is? And I thought, you know, of all the films that you could do it with, it wasn't as if it was unmotivated. It was, you know, it was a golden time, a golden age of the sands. There's a million reasons why the gold thing worked.
Yeah.
And I don't know it would be that easy, quite frankly. I don't know I'd like the job of getting a viable golden palette working without it becoming insipid. Because yellow on skin tones can look kind of a bit icky, really, sometimes.
Yeah, it didn't have that. And I will grant you that if you took it on a shot-by-shot basis, the shots looked good. It wasn't bad color work. I just personally became so aware of it after a while, to the extent that what I'm saying was true. I mean, when we finally got to the flashback, it was like having been out in the hot sun and suddenly getting to dive.
It's so funny
because
I went the other way. I stopped noticing it. No, it didn't build. It went the exact opposite way for me. I started appreciating, you know what, that would be a really hard grade. This crowd, to hold those golden tones without making people's skin look odd, was technically difficult. And then after I got over that, I just actually learnt to kind of go with it in the way that I happily watched Casablanca and, you know, go with it as a black and white. In fact, I kind of applauded the fact that they stuck their neck out and were so distinctive. It wasn't gratuitous in the sense that there was no reason why this film should be golden. What the hell am I looking at? This was set in New York in the 60s, huh?
Yeah.
It was, you know.
Do you think it would have been a better... I mean, do you think they could have designed the shots to support the look a little better? Did it feel a little maybe cluttered on screen, or just like the design at times was just not as unified?
Production design or color design? Because I've got
to
tell you, I'm really
support the color.
Okay, because I'm going the other way with you on this color.
Yeah, no. I'm not gonna.
No, it's fine. I think it's great that you got a different opinion.
Having established that we differ on that one, I'm just curious if you.
I
Because I found it kind of mediocre, the production design of it. And again, it seemed to borrow a lot from Pirates.
Yeah, that didn't... I mean, look, the only things that bothered me, I've got to say, are things that seemed downright odd or stupid. One of which was, let's go down to a room full of insane ninjas for no apparent reason and just have insane ninjas everywhere. And then this...
Or Sufi dervishes or...
Yeah, there was just, you know, odd bits of...
Although that was kind of cool.
Really? Why is this going on kind of thing?
Yeah.
And the other thing was, there was a couple of weird... I just actually, to this day, I do not understand why they went to the place where they didn't find the thing that they were trying to do when they got attacked by the ninjas. Like, I just lost the plot at that point. I was like, so where are you going? You got to put the thing where? And then what? Then it was like, huh? It was sort of like, we need some reason for them to travel. Well, you're going over here. Why? It's not important. When they get there, they're going to get attacked. Why? It's not important. And then they're going to go over here again.
Yeah.
Okay, well, and it's all been foretold
by the leading lady who... She basically explains it all for you.
I didn't really... So when they were at the goats herding mountain of boredom of whatever that thing was, I just was like, what are we doing? Can we just go back to the film for a second? Oh, here come the ninjas. Oh, okay, we had to go here to have a ninja attack. Oh, I get it. What did you think of the... of the ninjas, by the way? I've asked you this before. I don't think I got an answer.
What did I think of the ninjas?
These, you know, these black storm cloudy things, and they had like, these snakes and the...
I mean, I don't know if we're going into the creature work or there was something
Work and how they kind of dealt with them, yeah.
Right, and the Hansassin dude, are we including him? He had a pretty interesting look, which was pretty nicely enhanced, right?
Yeah. I thought the snake was the only creature work in it that wasn't magnificent. It wasn't bad. It just was, you know, some of the other creature work was really good, but the snake in the...
But I think, again, I think they... It was, to me, it was the shot design that undermined it. I thought the snake itself was all right, but...
It looked great in the super close-up.
It's so cheesy to just have it center frame and just striking right at the camera. Like, I...
It lacked the class of an Indiana sequence where, it didn't have that charm and kind of wit and intelligence to it. But
no,
I didn't actually think some of the snake work at the fire campsite didn't really stand out as being as good. What did you think of the flashback lion? Did you?
I liked it.
Yeah, I thought it was good.
I thought it was great. And those shots were so short.
Yeah.
You know, blink and you miss the appearance of that thing. But
unless they were recycling a lion, somebody's still gone to a lot of trouble to put that sucker together.
Oh, yeah. And they definitely got shots that would have been pretty tough to get any other way.
Yeah.
So, they were great. Put that on your reel and wait for your phone to ring, because that was good work.
I think with any of these films, the thing I dread most is if they do a sequel and they amp up the metaphysical hocus-pocus. Because the trouble is, you need to believe to a certain extent that people are flesh and blood and will have risk of peril. And once everything becomes just too magical and no one can die and everyone can do whatever they want, then it just isn't that engaging. But that's a plot point and I should leave it alone and move on.
No, but yeah, there was not a lot of suspense, really, was there?
No, but look, I think it was a good ride. If I was a, 16-year-old kid who'd caught the train into town to watch it with a mate, I'd have thought it was good. I applaud Disney for not sticking any sort of gratuitous sex in it. It was obviously a relatively sexist arrangement of leading characters, but that's kind of the genre, and I can go with that. But it certainly wasn't Transformers gratuitous soft porn. No, seriously, man, that shot of her on the back of the motorbike at the beginning of that last Transformers film was just like, I was like trying to cover my daughter's eyes. And also I thought the early Jake, the prince's early scenes when he was meant to be 7 years old, that was a delightful sequence. Set the film up well, and you know, I liked it. So I did feel good about it. I thought that the Moroccan landscape looked terrific. The matte paintings were great, and I say the production value provided by some brilliant particle work all the way through as sort of subtle stuff, the stuff that doesn't normally get, you know, the nod.
We had that, since you mentioned the opening, we had that reverse aging shot of Ben Kingsley as well, or I mean sequence of him, yeah?
That's true, yeah, that's true.
And that wasn't Lola, who's the house that almost always gets that work, right?
Yeah.
I thought it looked good. I mean, I don't know. Ben Kingsley's tough because he's a pretty mature-looking dude at any age, right?
Absolutely.
I mean, he looked less jowly.
Yeah, no, so. I thought it was good. I mean, it's not an easy thing to pull off, and I think that they did a good job. There wasn't matte problems in this. There wasn't bad comp problems in this.
No.
I think that, once again, that combination of, you know, CineSite, excellent facility, MPC, excellent facility, DNEG, excellent, Framestore, excellent. It's just there's not a weak player in that group. Mm-hmm. And it shows on screen. You don't get, you know, a sequence where you go, oh my Lord, is that a temp shot? But I've got to tell you, when that crowd started back on, do you remember the film? It was a TV show, Lost in Space.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that? And that was like one of the first...
The movie, that one? Yeah.
Yeah, the first collaborative efforts from the UK crowd. There were shots in that with the little nymph monkey thing that I was like, oh my God, that has to be a temp shot. There's no way that... just another time to put the textures on it.
well, that's and, good. Decade ago now, right?
Oh, or more.
More,
and,
yeah.
And run the clock forward and you've got Batman, you've got this, you've got the Bond stuff. It's... they're an absolute force to be reckoned with. And there's such depth to those facilities now that it's incredible.
Yeah.
Really, really good. All right. Look, thank you so much for taking time to join us again, Mark. We really appreciate it. I love having you on the show. It's great. Oh, tell me, what have you been up to lately?
I actually had a little adventure recently. I got called to on-set supervise on this little indie feature, which I've been specializing on that in that kind of work for the last couple of years a bit. And it's really fun for me because, as opposed to being, you know, a small fish in a huge pond, like Avatar, I can actually make a big difference on these movies. And this one, it's funny because there are two films that were in Sundance Writers Workshop together, apparently, and they were both the two that were considered unfilmable that year. And now I've actually supervised on both of them. But
the unfilmables.
That's right.
Cool.
And this one is interesting because they are trying to do creature work on $1 million overall budget. So anyway, they flew me down. We were in the bayou on the Gulf, and I even took my kids with me, and it was an adventure for them. The star of the film is 6-year-old, so unlike what a disaster it would be on most movie sets to bring your kids, this one was actually pretty kid-friendly. It was vivid. I mean, being in that part of the world at this time, and the theme of the movie is basically Armageddon. So it was definitely a vivid experience. I was really unconvinced about the ability to do any creature work the way they were thinking of doing it until I saw some of the rest of their work, which is not trying to do like a lot of the movies we do on this show do, which is just basically suspend your disbelief at all costs, despite your skepticism. They're going for something a little more poetic and kind of, I want to say, kind of metaphorical. And once I saw that, you know, once I saw how really beautiful the work was that they'd done, you know, basically on short films for this. You know, I decided to throw in with these guys, and so we'll see what happens next. But
well, I mean, I love your work. I think you've got a great eye, so I'm sure it'll be good. I look forward to seeing it.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, we're still negotiating who's actually going to do the post on it. There's all kinds of questions there, but it was certainly a fun adventure to just help them out with the on-set stuff.
Well, you're just such a you just don't get flustered and buzzed out, and I think you'd be a joy to have on set. I'd love to shoot with you on set. I think it'd be great fun.
Yeah.
Mark, where's the best place for people to check out where you're at or follow you? Or,
you know, I'm still going to just give the usual answer of following Flow Seeker on Twitter. I'll have a better answer hopefully soon, but for now, let's just go with that.
That's quite a good answer. I want to think a big shout out to both Todd and Matt, our two producers who produced the show. We produce this show about every fortnight or so, and it's a huge amount of work that these guys put in, both editing the show and producing show notes and producing material for us in terms of research and stuff. And they're just always great fun, and they're going to be joining us, both of them actually, at SIGGRAPH, which is coming up relatively soon. Are you going to make it down to SIGGRAPH?
Yeah, I haven't decided. It's in LA, so...
Yeah, come on down, man. We're putting the band together. Everyone's going to be in town. We're going to go out and have a good time. But it's also such a good trade show. Yeah. But yes, it'll be one of the few times we have nearly all the VFX show team together. Mm-hmm. And we also have some new people that'll be joining the VFX show in coming weeks. We're very excited to have them join our roster. Yeah. Of course, we have a great selection of people already, but... people like Mark, as you've just heard, regularly are working, doing normal jobs. So it's not fair to hit on anyone. I'm the only person that doesn't do anything for work, so I'm the one that's always on the show.
Well, those guys are going to be great. I mean, yeah. I think we're not revealing yet who you bring on, but it's going to be good.
Yeah, just some really... In addition to the great guys we've already got on, right? We you know, it's been a joy. This show is listened to very widely amongst the effects houses. And when we started hinting that we wanted to get some great new people, and we got some real senior people that were very keen to contribute. So we thank them, and we thank you guys for listening, because genuinely it's been a pleasure doing the show, and it's been hugely successful, especially in the last 6 to 9 months. So thanks so much for that. As always, you can find me over at FX Guide and FX PhD. And as I said, we'll be building up to SIGGRAPH, where we'll be doing some fun stuff, especially for you. Until next time, I'm Mike Simwell. Thank you so much, Mark. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
See you guys.